Thanks for the invitation. I very much enjoyed the days up to now. Let's hope it's going to be an enlightening morning too. So I, within the blood flow regulation context, I thought I'd try to give you an overview also about other things that we do in the lab. But of course, to give you again the context, it's a bit maybe it's a bit overstressing the context, but I think nevertheless it's important to give again some kind of a background. So it's all about activity changes and what happens actually if you induce these changes. So we work mainly in the vibrissal system, as David has pointed out. If we look at the neural activity changes upon a single whisker deflection with 2 Hz, measured with silicon probes in the barrel cortex, we have these very marked increases in multi-unit activity and local field potentials. And these increases from the baseline activity lead, of course, to an increase in metabolic demand, an increase in oxygen energy substrate demand, and with it, an increase in local cerebral blood flow. Now, of course, how this exactly works, we have learned this is by no means known, and a lot of things remain to be investigated better. A cartoon tries now to illustrate my view on, or actually, I would almost say a general view on the interplay between the neurons, here schematically the synapses, and the astrocyte, the astrocytic network, and the vasculature. So I think we would all agree on the notion that we are talking about the neuron glia vascular unit when we talk about the regulation of cerebral blood flow to be in register with the local metabolic demand. Now, I'd like to talk about 3 things today. I'd like to talk about the vascular topology, very nicely introduced yesterday by the members of the group of David. And I'd like to talk a bit more, maybe also on a complementary basis, how we study vascular topology and how we study the fluid dynamics, what happens actually with a modeled flow through a pipe system when we regulate locally the vascular resistance in a simulation. The next topic would be, and this brings us a bit away from cerebral blood flow, maybe it's nice to sort of integrate it more in a metabolism framework. I'd like to talk a little bit about metabolic compartmentation. What I mean by that is classical textbook views would say that glucose is the sole energy substrate for the neurons, and that the neurons actually directly get glucose from the vasculature. There are other concepts that believe that maybe glucose is taken up by astrocytes, is converted to glycolytically converted to lactate, that is then shuttled over to the neurons. I'd like to talk a little bit about this metabolic compartmentation in the second part. In the third part, very short, I'd like to show results from an experiment where we have tried to elucidate the mechanisms that actually drive this neuron vascular signaling. It's been thought that this is mediated by glutamate receptors on the astrocytes. We've heard a lot about it. I give you one example of an experiment where we doubt this result, at least in certain aspects of it. So, 3 parts: vascular topology and fluid dynamics, metabolic compartmentation, and a bit on neuron glia vascular signaling. So let's then go right into the first part. We have done in the past quite a bit of vascular corrosion casts. Let me introduce maybe the basic technology of this method. What you do is you perfuse the animal and then inject normally via the heart ventricle polymer that then very, very quickly polymerizes one can then look at the at this cast structure. After maceration of the tissue, we can look at it with the scanning electron microscope. This is a view, a coronal section through the rat brain. So we're looking actually straight onto the somatosensory cortex, and we see sort of a first view of this very intricate vascular network with the principal cortical vessels diving into the cortex. And the main basic building principle, as again we have heard this yesterday already, we have of course a delivery of the blood via the surface, and then again a drainage of the venous blood again through surface veins. Now if we a bit dark. If we go zoom in a little bit more, that this is again the rat somatosensory cortex transition to white matter. Now in panel B, we go and look at corrosion casts in the visual cortex of the macaque monkey. This is quite an operation to establish a full vascular corrosion cast filling in an animal that is about 6 kilos. It's very difficult to do, but it's doable, and one can actually arrive with quite good and complete fillings. I will show more examples of this. Now if we zoom in a little bit more, so that's the beauty about this approach, we can actually appreciate fine structures of the vasculature, because of course scanning electron microscopy is a method with an enormous capacity in spatial resolution. So we can appreciate these the structure, the fine structure of, for instance, a pile artery giving rise to a penetrating a cortical artery here. We can clearly see this space actually that is still peel space, but also the first, the upper molecular layer, which is completely void of vessels. And then the capillary bed then actually starts just below this demarcation line. Now, this is what we've seen yesterday already in a couple of slides, these so-called plastic strips, so corrosion cast specialists have called them plastic strips around the vessel, because they eventually couldn't make sense out of them, and they wouldn't want to name them actually as smooth muscle cells or whatever, because thinking about it, this is quite a strange phenomenon. We fill the vasculature, yet we see something that is sort of enwrapping the vasculature. We can clearly see that there is, if so, this is a section actually through through a corrosion cast. So how you do this is you actually immerse the cast in water and cut it and then lyophilize the structure, and then you get these very good views on these faces of the cut. What we can clearly see is that there is a space between the filled lumen, so we would expect this to be sort of the major thing of the vascular corrosion cast, but in arteries, particularly on the surface, we see these fillings also of a kind of ensheathment of the vessels, and nobody up until now actually knows exactly what this is all about. But probably what happens is that with these quite high pressure injections of the polymer, we somehow open a fenestration of the vasculature and actually squeeze the resin into probably smooth muscle spaces or whatever.
Labels, you know, on the surface and then the penetrating vessels, and then disappear.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you're not quite sure if it's anatomy or
It's
just
very
something else.
difficult. It could be anatomy that sort of these vessels are more prone to sort of give up, or whether it's a pure a phenomenon of actually mirroring the pressure drop along the vasculature. We don't know, and I think nobody knows right now. The problem is that I actually never was too motivated to actually go into the details because, in my view, this is never going to be something that represents a true anatomical finding because it's very hard to tell whether it's still sort of a biased artifact that we shouldn't be too much concentrating on. But it's an interesting phenomenon that we see this, of course, only in the arteries, and we see it much more in the monkey than in the rodent, much more. And it's not a residue of a tissue residue. This is for sure. So what could happen also is that upon maceration that you have a tissue residue that you also sputter coat and then actually image in the scanning electron microscope. It's clearly not a residue. It's a cast filling of a structure enwrapping the vasculature. We believe it's probably a smooth muscle sheath that we somehow fill up. Yes?
Does it depend
Yeah, as David pointed out, it's sort of more on the bigger pile vessels, and then just when we go down in the penetrating arteries, still there, and they become more and more sparse along this line. Yeah. Yes. Very good idea. Exactly. No, this would. I think we sh I think this should be done. Then this discussion would be over for all times. Yeah, I completely agree. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It could be. Yeah.
Because this is also what, I mean, this type of brain structure is also is a possible cause. I mean, it should be there in a way.
In a way, yes.
So, but there must be a hole.
Yes.
In the somehow a hole in the arterial.
Exactly. Somewhere here we would have a portal connection between the lumen and these guys, for sure. Yes. We haven't found these portals. I mean, there are different kinds. It's a bit more viscous than blood, but not much. So these polymers are quite nice to work with. And there is it all depends on how you actually mix them up, how much solvent to resin ratio and so on. But you can get it to a viscosity that is actually nice to work with.
And some of the damaged vessels, you see something very similar. It seems like the dye actually leaks into something about the match. I'm not quite sure why that happens, but
yeah.
It looks very similar.
Okay.
To this.
Yeah. I wouldn't, I can, we can look it up afterwards. I don't know it by heart. Okay, nice thing and very, very clear is the distinguishment between arteries and veins. The arteries have these footprints of endothelial cell nuclei that are that have a very nice and elongated shape, whereas on the veins you have these rather sluggish looking round imprints. This, of course, in a way, of, is very much dependent on the pressure situation in these vessels. Okay, so this, now the monkey work actually I did in collaboration with Nikos Logothetis in Tübingen. This is our PhD student, Annalena Keller, who actually has done a corrosion cast and has really excelled in developing corrosion cast techniques in the monkey. And this is a large quarter of a monkey brain, the visual cortex, V1 here, that we have analyzed. So that's the corresponding anatomy. So we can now image these very, very large samples and get in modern scanning electron microscopes with motorized stages, we can actually nicely image the whole such a whole face. Of course, it's always only a face, and that's the downside of this technique in terms of quantification. Now, if we go into primary visual cortex, we can clearly see the basic structure of the vasculature surface vessels in a very nice orderly fashion. We have the penetrating arteries and veins. We can also, if we squint our eyes, clearly see that we have differences in the vascular density. I will show other data on that, but you can clearly by naked eye see that you have highest vascular densities in around about layer 4. Which we also have shown with immunohistochemistry that we have the highest vascular density down there. So the gradient in the monkey primary visual cortex is much, much higher than, for instance, in extrastriate cortices, and also much more prominent than in the rodent, as we have seen yesterday. So again, B1, very, very impressive surface vessels, huge surface vessels. Again here, again these ring-like structures. Pile surface, B1. Going into V2. I haven't analyzed that, but it could be that there is a difference. But as I said, I was always a bit hesitant to quantify this because you never know whether it's really biased by a very strange phenomenon that doesn't tell us anything about the functionality of these things. I will show some data on V1 blobs. We haven't looked into stripes in V2, but the difference is in V1, although the blobs are very prominent, the vascular differences are very, very minute. I will show that. I mean, no obvious correlations. Very, very similar to what Pablo has shown yesterday. I will show one feature where we have looked at this, namely the V1 blobs, but I'll come to that later. Okay, Now, this is now STS, superior temporal sulcus, and you can see, of course, completely different from the data that we've seen yesterday in the rat, that in the monkey cortex we have these completely differently oriented pile vessels within a sulcus, and you can nicely see this here. So the this is of course a very very trivial difference between monkey and rat's cortex. Now this is huge tiling of electron micrographs from again primary visual cortex, and what we have done here is we've counted the arteries and the veins on the surface on the face of this structure, and then have tried to recompute the arteriovenous ratio, and this is this discrepancy between our data and the rodent data. We clearly have more arteries than veins in our hands looking at the primate, which seems to be not the case in the rodent. This data, by the way, in a very recent paper by a French group, has been on the dot been replicated now. We found the same actually in several monkeys, and now again in another species in the Calitrix, I think, in the French group, they have also found this 1.6 to 1 in the primary visual cortex.
Did you, so it needs to be self-consistency. Did you measure the diameter, give a mean diameter for the arteries and a mean diameter for the veins, and then you, like from Doppler, you can get the different speeds, and then you know the flux, then you can see if, at least on average, is this number consistent with a balanced flux between the arteries?
We haven't looked at it. We haven't looked at it. There's one point I think it should be done. Nevertheless, I'm also a bit hesitant about it because I don't think that we have a good estimate and a true estimate of the venous diameter with this technique and with all filling techniques. I think we underestimate probably the true venous diameter, but this is another matter. But I think nevertheless we should really look into this. Oh yes, oh yes. You can see this I think class 6 of Duvernoy that really drives all the way down without any collaterals right through the cortex into white matter without giving off one collateral. I mean they're not they, no they I mean they're I haven't looked at that specifically, but I mean they are quite sparse. I mean they're not very numerous compared to the rest of the cortical vessels. But this is an interesting thing. We should. Yeah, but these are I mean many. But yeah, but these are by all means they are not all of them that go directly without giving off collaterals. There are also guys that go down, give off collaterals, maybe rather deep down in the cortex, and then still go into the white matter. Yeah, it's actually something we've also looked into in the monkey, and we have the same main tendency as in the rodent, but it's not consistent. They dive over each other. Yep. It's not, it's, there is the same tendency in the monkey, but it's not straight forward. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Of course. This is actually a nice thing that that you don't get on the arterial side.
So this structure kind of explains why you have sort of explain the consistent with the fact that you see veins on top of arteries, but the vein is going to be shared between two sides and has to be more.
That's a good idea, it's a good point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this gives us this ratio, and it's really completely different. When I first counted this ratio, I thought this makes complete, I mean, this makes sense to have more arteries than veins, because we the draining doesn't even matter whether it's from two completely distant areas as we have in these sort of joint drainers between two cortical areas, as we have seen just now. Doesn't matter, we just need to collect it back to the trunk. But of course, on the arterial side, it makes sense to have a finely detailed delivery system. So I thought this makes perfect sense. But now I'm puzzled that you are quite confident that that it's the other way around in rats and mice. Yeah. But this is something I believe we'll have to put our heads together. Yeah.
What's the number of 0.44?
So that would be a very rough estimate of the number of arteries and veins we have counted. These are really the penetrating cortical arteries and veins that we have put in relation to the volume of the samples.
The volume is smaller for the arteries.
Yes.
The numbers are larger.
Yeah, that's, of course, that's exactly making it up.
But Martin, you have to have the same
Now, the only thing I'm trying to make here, the point that I try to make here is that the territory that a principal cortical artery is feeding is smaller than that of a draining vein, just very trivially based on the numbers per volume of these vessels. Very, there's no magic about it. Now, this is not a corrosion cast from us. This is from the Harrison paper. I put it in yesterday. Look at this thing. I mean, the main point he's making in his paper is that there is a good, a consistent overlap between his activation in auditory cortex using optical imaging of intrinsic signals and the corrosion cast data. So he had only, I think, activation in this area where the vessels are. But look at the, I mean, the only thing I trust in this paper are the scale bars. Look at this. Look at this. It's just impossible. Also, the data that we've seen yesterday with the microstrokes, it's impossible that you have a cortical area void of vessels along such huge stretches. And there is proof that the fillings are incomplete. You have these sudden stops of filling here, 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 here. All this tapering off of the resin fillings are all signs of incomplete fillings.
Yeah.
So there's no question about it that this is complete rubbish. Okay, now this is data from immunohistochemistry. What we've done is now in classical sectionings of the visual cortices of the monkey brain, we've used anticollagen type 4 to stain the basal membrane, and then we've applied stereology to come up with length density, surface density, volume fraction, and vessel diameter in these areas. I'd like to concentrate only on this. So we are in primary visual cortex of the macaque monkey. We see here the cortical lamina depth in micrometers here, and we see here the overall vascular density, the length density. We have about, in the monkey brain, about half a meter of vessels within a cubic millimeter. And you see the gradient topping in layer 4C, actually in layer 4C beta in the striate cortex with the highest vascular density. This gradient comes mainly from the small vessels in blue here, not from the large vessels. Now, what we've also done, we've quantified cytochrome oxidase in V1 and correlated this relative measure of oxidative metabolism, and this is the gradient you get of the COX activity along the cortical depth, and it very, very well matches the vascular density in this area. We only done this for V1. But it's a much better estimate. It's a much better correlation between this metabolic marker shown here and the vascular density shown here than between cell densities or synapse densities that other people have measured in the. Not one-to-one, no. So the point we have made is sort of that the mere element density doesn't really tell us about sort of steady state metabolic demands, but it's rather probably an activation state that is then driving both metabolism and the vascular density. B is DAPI stain. It's a Nissle, DAPI, COX, and collagen. But it's actually very much lighter. It's also the lightest one. So this is now a V1 data. This is a tangential section of a V1 slab. where you see these patches, these cytochrome oxidase rich patches that have been described many, many years ago for the first time. Their function is not completely clear. What is clear is that they receive direct thalamic input. This is, by the way, most prominent in layer 3. And there was a paper, a neuroscience paper, I think 1991, that claimed that the vascular density within the blobs compared to between the blobs is dramatically different. And it came from Purvis's group, and he claimed that the difference was up to 40% between blobs and interblobs. Something that you would expect. I mean, these blobs are rather big. They're about 300 to 400 microns big. And we thought back in Nikos Logothetis' lab that we should be able to get them with functional magnetic resonance imaging, for instance, using blood volume measurements. We should see them if the vascular density was so dramatically different. But we couldn't. Nobody could. Nobody could visualize so far the blobs in with MRI. Yes. So we have recomputed all this. Took us quite a while, and we've come up with completely different measures. And it's just one order of magnitude wrong, the data of Purvis's vascular densities. I think they mixed up one zero was too many. And sorry? Sometimes. It's about, so the difference is at most about 4% between the blobs and interblobs in length density of the vessels. So there is a difference. Yes, he was right, but the difference is very, very small. And you would never detect such a small difference in vascular density with non-invasive imaging. I actually, this is overall vascular density. Overall vascular density. But we've also looked at the number of penetrating vessels. And there, the situation is a bit, is a bit, is even opposite. We see more penetrating vessels in the interblobs than in the blobs. Unless you look at the very big ones, this is this graph down here. I think we could discuss this later in detail. But if you set the threshold of counting the penetrating vessels very high, so we only count the very large penetrating vessels, then you have more in the blobs than in the interblobs. Without knowing.
So that's the center, this is the visual cortex.
Visual cortex.
Barrel cortex, the center, I mean, for a
Yes,
sense,
yes.
hemispheric connection. Is
Yes.
that the same?
It's different. I mean, there are parallels between the blobs and the barrels, but it's not comparable directly. Yeah, that would be completely in line with this data. Yeah. Right. Right. The escalators in the middle of your living room, yeah.
Isn't that what Tchaikovsky also said like 50 years ago?
No, actually not. It's the opposite. It's quite the opposite, yes. Whether Tom Woolsey actually has seen the same thing, but he's claimed the opposite. He said that he found sort of a main feeder per barrel in a way.
In all fairness, there's one data point which he identified. It was a discussion. I think
the figure is, I mean, shows clearly that.
But it's a discussion. I mean, because he injected sensitive care, he injected dye or vessel, sort of pop out the neighboring vessels. But I think Bruno's point is unless you reconstruct huge bodies of fissure, you can't possibly make these kind of statements.
But you didn't say that the kind of the vessel came down into the middle of the barrel.
No, that. Yeah.
Came to the side. No. Yeah. Kind of similar.
Kind of similar, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason to discredit everybody else because it didn't have the same technique.
No, I'm not discrediting at all. I mean, but. Okay. Actually, if they correspond to the pinwheels, it's the pinwheel centers. So that's the interesting thing, actually. So that the blobs with this high steady state metabolic activity are probably one of the theories why they are metabolically so active is because they sit in the center, meaning that they have no orientation tuning, meaning that they are active irrespective of the orientation input, meaning that they are on average more active. So I mean I've never recorded from the blobs, but the data, the scarce data that is available, tells us that the orientation tuning within the blobs is very, very bad. Yeah, there. I think there is quite a convergence of this, and this makes, in a way, sense that we have higher overall metabolic activity in the blobs. Okay, this is the last slide on this matter, where we have looked at the cytochrome oxidase activity, the dots here within the different layers of V1, and these are the cytochrome oxidase activities between blobs and interblobs. So they lie really within the range of the laminar activity, meaning that we can expect also vascular densities that are in this range, and by no means sort of 40% more. We would expect much higher cytochrome oxidase activity differences, or at least that the blobs were well beyond the range of the laminar CO activity. So that's another hint that this lies all very, very near together, both in vascular density and cytochrome oxidase activity. Okay, so vascular topology, one of the big downs for corrosion casts and also for immunohistochemistry using classical sectioning of the tissue is that it's very hard to have the full appreciation of the 3D topology of the vascular network. That's why we have started to collaborate with the Paul Scherrer Institute, the Swiss light source. It's a synchrotron. And one of the beamlines actually concentrates on tomography, on X-ray tomography. And this is the beamline end, so here it's hard to see, I'm sorry. This is the beam comes out here, and we have the sample here, and a CCD camera with a scintillator in front here, and we rotate the sample, so not with in a classical computed tomography where you rotate the source. Here we rotate the sample and acquire high resolution planar images of the projections of the attenuation, and then we can reconstruct the vascular network based on these. The nice thing about this technique, very complementary to the techniques used in David's lab, is that we are quite fast in acquiring these huge chunks of data. So it takes 10 minutes to acquire 2 by 2 by 2 kilovoxels with an isotropic nominal is a voxel size of 700 nanometers. So this is quite enough to reconstruct the vasculature within the cortex down to the capillary. This is a reconstruction and already applied some fluid dynamics modeling of the pressure field and the flux in such a vascular network. What is missing is the top. We originally had big problems in acquiring the data from the top because we had full attenuation of the beam through these big vessels at the top. That's why we had a lot of artifacts up there. So, but reducing actually increasing the voxel sizes and tuning the energy, we can now acquire also the large vessels at the top. Yes. Now the what we have very recently done, this is very very recent and unpublished data, is we have reconstructed single cortical vessels here, cortical arteries. What we have done is we have taken a surface seed point, and then we have actually truncated this vascular the vascular network where after a certain threshold, we set this threshold to 8 microns. So when a vessel reaches a thickness of below 8 microns, we truncated the vessel tree. And this gives us, in a way, the topology of these feeding arteries. This is one, a couple more, or about 100 just overlaid, aligned in direction, and then plotted here. Gives us an idea about again the feeding volume of such a system. Same thing for the cortical veins. One. A couple of more, and about 100 overlaid on each other. Can go through you. This is a monochromatic beam. Of course, it depends highly on the energy, but for this kind of, and they tune the energy to be just right for the sample. We normally use about 20 kilo electron volts for these samples. But they could even go away from monochromatic beams to white beam. There are, of course, you trade this high photon flux in for beam hardening effects and things like that, but I'm not an expert in these very details. But you can, if you want fast acquisition, high penetration, you'd probably go to even non-monochromatic beams, and then you have an enormous penetration. You can easily go up to a cubic to 1 mL without you can put in a whole mouse brain.
And then you wreck it for 2 days.
Yeah. We haven't done it.
Yeah.
Yet. Yeah. You could do it. Yes.
And then 2 years of computer.
Come to this.
Give us just a sense of the fidelity of the data set. Did you fill all the capillaries in see any loose ends, so to speak?
We do, yes.
No loose ends.
We do see loose ends, and we have practically the same problems as you have. We have to relax thresholds around these loose ends. We have to sometimes even assume that we have maybe had big barium sulfate bubbles. So I forgot to tell that these are, of course, we need to get contrast into the tissue. That's why we have to fill the vasculature with an X-ray absorber. We use barium sulfate, very, very heavy loads of barium sulfate. Could be that the MILT's suspension contains large fractions that block from time to time a capillary. We have dead ends where even threshold relaxation does not work, but we have very, very obvious partners that we connect using cost function reconnection algorithms that we've sort of tried to implement. This is by far not yet optimal. In terms of fluid dynamics, I think, no, I haven't, but this is a good point that one should do a sort of a sensitivity analysis, you know, when, at what level, at what stage, and in what numbers such disruptions really then change the results. We haven't done it. But this is a very important step to take, and actually straightforward to make artificial disruptions and place them at different in different numbers at different levels of the vessel of the vessels, and then see how this affects the pressure field. No, that's true. No. We have actually, when we started, we thought that it might be a problem, and we have actually used for the capillary bed a continuous porous medium to model the flow. But now we don't use it anymore because we can easily compute it also for the full capillary network. Okay, now the topological structure. This is from a rather a classical paper where they have introduced the Strahler topology method to describe such vascular branches. And don't want to go too much into the details, but this is one of the ways to classify the branching orders of a structure. This actually originates in classification of rivers, and maybe good to know is that we in the Strahler method actually order zero is not the backbone, but is actually the smallest vascular structure or structure in general of the network. It makes kind of sense to start at the smallest ones because otherwise, if you start up here, the capillaries could end up in having completely different classes. This is something, of course, that would not be what you want. So you start off at the known smallest element, give them order zero, and then whenever two of the same orders join, you jump up in one order. This is the classical Strahler method. The modified Strahler method actually takes into consideration also changes in the diameter. So you would, there are slight differences where you, for instance, here, one and two, this goes straight still into two. So only we would have a class three if this would be a two also. This is not the case here because we have an increase in the diameter that surpasses a certain thresholds. So you assign class 3 even though you have class 1 and class 2 that actually feed this next order branch. So this is a so-called modified diameter-dependent Strahler classification here. Now, if we look at these elements now in our samples, we see that we have, so again, this is not capillary, this is pre-capillary, because we actually stop just before we end up in the capillary bed. So this is the mean diameter of an element, and you see that we have larger diameters of the elements that are from venous networks than from arterial networks throughout the element order from 0 to. They get 0 up to 4 to 7. We have pooled them here because, of course, they get very, very few up there. And they are also very, very they're very, very different from each other. So the error bar is huge if you do this for every single class. Yes? This is rat data. Yes?
So the veins have the same kind of volume as the arterial for the same class. The veins are not more like bulky.
They are, they are bigger. It's significant all over the smaller classes, yes, but not. I mean, the numbers are very small, and the differences are very, very huge.
It's confusing because mean diameter doesn't mean that arteries and veins are the same. I mean, that's just a relative ranking. It's not an absolute number.
That's microns. Yes, it's microns.
Mean diameter is just a relative number, or it's microns.
It's microns.
Well, it's microns.
Yeah. I mean, they are significantly different. There's no.
But is the order zero, so we're coming out of capillaries.
Yeah, then they are practically the same, okay?
But when we've got a higher order, since the speed is down for the veins, you learn that the diameter is bigger, right?
Yeah. It is bigger, but one would expect this difference to be even larger. That's one point, but you claim that they are much more numerous.
Well, forget about
that. Yeah. But this is an important point, of course. There's one more point that I think is really important here again. I'm a bit hesitant to take the venous diameter as a very, 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 very correct measure because I think we underestimate the venous diameter with these injections.
What's the injection backwards? Instead of injecting into the artery, you inject it into the vein. Then you worry that you're injecting into the artery, and that it's viscous and the pressure is falling.
Exactly.
Off, so the veins are
exactly.
So then you just inject into the vein.
It's hard to make a filling from both sides at the same time.
Yep.
At least, I mean, start with the this has been done. Start with the artery and then give also pressure on the venous side. If you are in the first phase with good filling from the arterial side, and then you actually switch to the venous side.
Exactly.
This has been done for other organs. Maybe this would be something we should do. Yeah. So yeah.
I think things are waiting for us, or we have a considerable amount of concern with smaller diameter capillaries, and when you people, and we have, you know, these rods still on, these are easier to
Yes.
Yeah, that's an answer.
Yeah, yeah, that's of course the best answer that you can provide. Yes.
Sure, you do that.
Yeah. So, and this is, by the way, this is really very, very recent data from the last couple of days, actually. So this is mean number of elements within a class, many, 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 many of these pre-capillary elements, and then going down in the numbers. The opposite is the mean length per element that then goes up with increasing Strahler order. And this is the mean number of segments per element. So a segment is between branch points, but they can belong together in the same elements, okay? So these elements have three segments, as pointed out here. So this is the mean number of segment per element that also goes up with the order and is much higher in for the veins than for the arteries.
I
yes. Strahler. Yeah. Yeah, but you have the loops. That's a very good point. You have the loops up at the pile surface. Down here, this is an important point, really. Down here, the anastomosis between such a branch and another one at the precapillary level are very, very sparse. So if we take these guys here and look how many of them actually are paired Strahlers. They're very, very sparse. Yeah, yeah. This is something which is not known, actually. Because arterial and venous anastomosis have been shown, and they are quite numerous on the surface. But really, in the cortex, they are very, very rare. This is a very interesting finding that we have to really get more evidence for it and quantify it, but we believe that the number of interconnected cortical arteries and venous branches are way below 10% of these branches. Sorry?
Pre-capillary.
Of course, they are completely interconnected when you go down to the capillary level. That's correct, yeah.
But I understood that you have more small veins than you have small arteries from the previous one. The number of elements, of segments per element, was about twice as high for veins than for arteries.
Yeah, but they are, I mean, this is within one of these structures.
Yeah.
The elements, the segments that are within one element of the same class, of the same order, is larger for the veins. I think it's very, for me, it's yet very, it's not intuitive what this means, I think. Because it could be a very short thing. It's difficult to say at this stage what this means. I haven't made an interpretation of this yet. Cannot say that there are more, clearly not. In the sense of venous density or so of these elements. As I said, this is very, very recent. A 100 microns. We haven't made that calculation yet, which is also not very easy to do, but sort of the, if you want, the envelope of this, of such a structure. We haven't done this properly yet. But if you look at this cylinder in a way, that's practically the cortical thickness here. Yeah. Well, no, they're, what we have done is we took all the major trunks, we've actually artificially put them over each other, even then merged them in the direction so that we could plot this like this. No, this is much too dense. But the capillaries are missing. So they induce, of course, another kind of vascular density.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Not yet, but this is of course the idea that we would now look into each single guy of on the left and right side and see where they give off most of the collaterals. This is of course now, since we have now the topological charts of each of these networks, we could do that. But this is not yet done. That's clearly on the list. Okay, now need to speed up a little bit. What we can do, as I've said before, is we can now apply a pressure to these intricate systems, and we can simulate in this passive plumbing network, we can induce a local radius change, for instance, in a feeding artery, and see what this has as an effect on the pressure change and on the flow change, both on the positive with a positive sign and a negative sign. This is something I think is very important because we yet don't really understand what a local constriction or dilation does in such a system. It's not trivial to foresee how this changes the whole situation. This is one example. As I said, a 10% dilation of one of the feeding cortical arteries here. And we have this circumscribed increase in the pressure and flow. Positive pressure change and surrounding negative pressure change here. This is, and we have made this for many different scenarios, also blocking, sort of simulating your strokes that you induced. And we also find that we have major breakdowns when we occlude such a penetrating artery, sort of very, very much in line with this bottleneck scenario of a cortical artery. We haven't done it for the vein, though. It could be interesting to also do it for the veins. Now, I don't want to stay with this too much, because what we have done here, we have really taken bloods as a Newtonian fluid in these simulations. And we now know, we always knew that it's wrong, but we have had no idea how wrong it was. And it's a disaster if you don't take this into account. And I show you very simple simulations where you can appreciate how damn wrong you are if you consider water running through these pipes. Why? Damn wrong, yes. So this is work mainly done, so all this fluid dynamics modeling has been done in collaboration with the ETH in Zurich, the Institute for Fluid Dynamics, and this particularly comes from them. And I try to give you an idea from a neurobiologist's view on how this actually can be appreciated. Now, this is The influence of the hematocrit on the flow resistance, and we're talking now about the phenomenon in very small vessels. These are the pressure drops within such a vessel. So this is plasma, erythrocyte, plasma erythrocyte, and you see the pressure drops along the, this element Lij. Now, the effective resistance really depends not only on the sort of mere length and diameter of this element, but also on the hematocrit, so the number of erythrocytes you have in such a tube. And it, of course, goes up the more of the erythrocytes you have in that tube. That's one of the things that actually are important. The other important things, this is called what we call the effective resistance, and other people have also, in biofluidics, have also called it effective resistance. The other thing is the bifurcation rule, very interesting thing that actually determines where in such a network the erythrocyte goes. Goes it in this branch or in that branch? We come to this in a second. So the way we have done it so far is we've just taken the analogy of the capillary and an electrical network to compute the flow rate through the system. Very straightforward, and other people have done that too. Now, the second, as I said, the second thing is the bifurcation rule, and it's been studied many years before that in large vessels, okay, this is the...
Sure.
Yeah? Well, actually, both. Now here, actually, what I would like to show here is the fractional blood flow. So, how much blood actually flows through, and this is for both erythrocytes and plasma. So, if you have a fractional flow in large vessel, that goes in a way more to one side, you also have a relative increase in erythrocytes that go more to that side, right? So this is this continuous situation of the bifurcation in large vessels. If you go down in the vessel size, you see that this step function, that the erythrocytes goes to the side with a steeper pressure gradient, and it always goes there. So it's not a continuous bifurcation rule anymore, but it's really a step function, deciding whether the red blood cell will go to this or that side.
So what happens if the red blood cell goes to the side with a steeper gradient?
Yes.
If it just sort of fills the vessel, then it destroys the gradient, and then the next vessel goes to another vessel.
That's what comes next. Yeah.
So that's a strong sentiment observed experimentally.
This is what we are right now trying to do with the two photon. I will show you how we try to do it. But this is not been shown. It has been kind of shown in the mesentery, but very rudimentary. And also, this has never been modeled. This has only been modeled very locally, and not in a network. So I think this is very exciting stuff. So what Dominic Obrist and Patrick Jenny have done at DETH is taken this very, very simplified model. And what they did is they chose an initial randomized RBC position, then computed the effective resistances, as I've explained it, And then computed the flow rates in the capillaries, propagated the RBCs, and then recomputed, applying the bifurcation rule, recomputed everything, and went back to the next iteration. So in a way, we could play now with applying the bifurcation rule, applying the effective resistance, or neglecting one of the two, or both, and look at what actually happens. This is when you now apply both rules. So the bifurcation rule and the effective resistance. And you can see that we have a total demixing. So we have not what you would expect, actually. This is now an injection of a blue tracer, if you want. You have not this homogeneous front that would travel through this very simplified network, but you have a highway, actually, completely unexpected in the middle. And this highway is only there if you apply now, really, these are the, I'm sorry, I will show this the steady state in a while. These are the speeds in analogy to the two photon data, the speeds at different points in this network, where you can also see reversals of flow in certain instances. But the steady state situation now with this highway of flow through this very simplified and completely unrealistic network, this highway is only there if you apply the bifurcation rule and the effective resistance. If you do not do that, you have, in a way, more a Kirchhoff situation and the expected front of movement into this structure. So we believe that applying the modeling without these local regulatory, in a way, autoregulatory mechanisms on the capillary side, this is only relevant for the capillaries. Neglecting these principles could be really, really problematic. And we're now just on the verge of implementing these rules for the larger networks. It's going to be very interesting to see the differences of it in a realistic model, in a realistic vascular network model. Yes. 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 That's the effective resistance. That's one of the two.
It's not really a resistance, it's a nonlinear dependence of the pressure on the
hematocrit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, sorry. They remodel it with a hexagonal network, exactly the same, but still 2D, still 2D. In a hexagonal network arrangement, it looks exactly the same. But we haven't done it in 3D, and we haven't done it in the realistic vascular topology. But it's just on the way. It's quite difficult to set the boundary conditions. If you have multiple inlets and outlets, that's the problem they're struggling with at the moment. It's very simple in this situation where you have one inlet and one outlet, but very difficult if you have many of them. I agree, but still it's interesting to see that there is this significant difference in this very, very simple play toolbox between including the bifurcation and effective resistance and not including them. This was the unexpected thing. Yeah, it will be interesting to see
And that's what I would expect the design principle of the field, so that if there are parts of the capillary network that are low in the cluster density.
Then
once we have that's not a good thing. Right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, absolutely.
So by the, so if design such that the cluster density then water, then water is not such a bad thing, right?
Yeah, honestly, I think we just need to see how it needs to be done, and either way, whatever comes out will be giving us interesting aspects about this whole thing. And at the moment I'm not in a situation to make predictions. I have to say, but I mean the engineers here thought that this could be a way to, in a way, an evolutionary way to select vessels, actually. So vessels with very low RBC flow would then, in a way, die out in such a system. So a way of selecting vessels that are relevant. But I'm a bit hesitant.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm a bit hesitant at this stage to make predictions in that direction. But I think it clearly, I think my message to you is that these things can really matter. That's, I think, what we can be sure of.
Let me just understand your prediction in terms of the experiment. You said you want to look for a place where that you have a branch in microvessels, and with a branch where downstream branches are roughly the size of a single red blood cell diameter,
mm-hmm.
at least kind of equal.
Yeah.
And then what you should see is anticorrelated flow.
Yeah. So, do I have the chance to talk a little bit about metabolic compartmentation? I will go through it very quickly because now we are making a shift in gears completely, going in vivo, and doing even radio tracer experiments. So this is a tool we developed ourselves, a so-called BIDAS probe, surface probe, to measure radioactive substance accumulation in the cortex. It's in a way a poor man's PET, but with quite a good temporal and spatial resolution, where we can sample cortical tracer accumulation over time. This is the situation in the in vivo experiment. So we place the surface beta probe on the cortex of the rat through this thin skull, and then we place an arterial venous shunt to measure the input curve of the radio tracer running through the blood, and we apply offline compartmental tracer kinetic modeling, classical PET kinetic modeling, to come up with rate constants of the tracer flowing through the system. This is nothing very fancy. What we have been doing here is we looked at glucose consumption with 18 fluorine labeled fluorodeoxyglucose. And we've looked at the influence when we have increased lactate levels in the blood. I told you that one of the ideas is that lactate is converted, glucose is converted to lactate in the astrocytes, and then eventually shuffled over to the neurons. So the idea here was to see how the cortex changes its glucose use under the influence of an increased lactate availability from the blood. Okay, so what we did is we increased lactate concentration from normal levels to very high levels. We looked at the local serum metabolic rate of glucose under these conditions. So this would be acquisition one, and then under increased plasma lactate levels. What you can see here is that we have a marked decrease in glucose metabolism under increased lactate availability. Meaning that, or one interpretation of this measurement would be that if brain cells have the availability of lactate, they will take it up and metabolize it, and glucose uptake and metabolism would go down. In a way, one of the interpretation could even go saying that blood-borne lactate could be preferred over glucose in such a situation. Otherwise, the brain would not have a reason to lower its glucose metabolism under these circumstances. Yes? No, actually, the idea is that the brain cells directly take up lactate, and that's why gross glucose consumption goes down. Why it is preferred, we don't know, this just tells us that it seems to lower glucose consumption if we increase the lactate availability. Yeah. Now, the next thing we did is to look at what really happens with the lactate metabolism. For this, we synthesized 11C L-lactate. Sorry. This is a short-lived marker. C11 has a half-life of 20 minutes, so it's produced online in the cyclotron unit, and then we inject it into the animal under different conditions. So the idea here of the tissue compartment is that lactate is taken up via monocarboxylate transporters on the neuron and then is converted and metabolized, and actually we have a cleavage of the labeled CO2. So for tracer kinetic modeling, that would mean that we have the K1 as a delivery constant and K2 as a clearance constant, reflecting actually CO2 washout, and by that measure of lactate consumption. And we've looked at lactate metabolism with this method under different conditions. Now, baseline conditions and stimulation. Here we used a trigeminal nerve stimulation to drive the somatosensory cortex. We see the rate constants K1 and K2. And we can clearly see that we have, under stimulation conditions, an increase of both rate constants, so an increased delivery, but also an increased clearance, so an increased lactate consumption under increased neuronal activity. So there was very little in vivo evidence, direct in vivo evidence, that lactate itself is really, that the lactate metabolism really increases under these circumstances. This is one way to prove, yes, it's really true, under neuronal activity, lactate metabolism goes up. We can block this with MCT transport blocking. This is this chart here. So forcin is an MCT transport blocker. How do you compare it?
Mm-hmm.
it's sure also increased. There's no question about it. In this sole experiment using 11C lactate, we cannot say this, whether it's preferred or not. This is from this result, we can only claim that we have an increased lactate consumption under increased neural activity. More than that, it's difficult to these are experiments that that last about 10 minutes.
You're
stimulating for 10 minutes? Yes. Infra orbital nerve. The tracer is given IV, yes. 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 And we have more with an increased washout interpreted as an increased lactate metabolism under stimulation conditions. Yes. Yeah, I know it. I know them. Yes, very nice. Exactly.
And burn the lactate.
Yep.
There's a net kind of consumption of lactate.
Yep.
Yeah.
Might be healthy to do sports.
Yeah. Or kind of lactate precondition.
Their results are very, very similar to ours, actually. There's nothing that would oppose our results. Very interesting studies. Okay, now.
Maybe that's right. But if you look at this guy, I would say he could live until he was at least 90. I mean, this guy's a big. He was quite young.
So, this is the last experimental series I'd like to share with you, where we did voltage-sensitive dye imaging under glucose deprivation. So what we did is a very rough experiment. This is now in the somatosensory cortex again, doing whisker stimulation, single whisker stimulations, and looking at the trace of the voltage-sensitive dye signal. Here you see the signal change in the region of the most prominent signal increase at baseline conditions and under heavy insulin influence. So under influence of insulin, of course, glucose concentration goes dramatically down. I will show you the data how much. But what we see is after about 150 minutes after insulin injection, we have a complete abolishment of the VSD signal. Now, the plasma values for glucose go dramatically down, and this is the time point where we have so almost isoelectricity, if you want, about 150 minutes. Lactate levels stay about the same. Now, if you look at the VSD amplitude, we see that it really goes dramatically down. Now, the idea of this experiment was then to give artificial glucose as a control. So we actually keep glucose, although we inject we inject insulin, we really keep artificially glucose level up by injecting directly glucose, and we see that we can sort of rescue the signal quite nicely with injecting glucose together with the insulin. This is in a way is quite a stupid control experiment, but clamping the glucose under insulin influence. But the critical experiment here is that when we give lactate instead of glucose, that we can also nicely rescue the signal. So the neurons can really nicely live under heavy glucose deprivation if you provide them with IV lactate. That's in a way one of the first in vivo evidence that neurons can really live on lactate. So last slide on metabolism and compartmentation of metabolism is we had the chance to collaborate with Jeong-Bun Park from University of Seoul, who has synthesized a very nice glucose analog that has a fantastic two-photon efficiency that is about 100 times brighter than what we had so far with 2 and 6 NBDG, which is very, very bad in terms of fluorescence yield. And we had the chance to use this in our hands and actually have looked at the uptake of this new glucose analog, which is probably not phosphorylated, so it's taken up. It's more like a transport tracer than a glucose metabolism tracer. But what we can, the images, I'm sorry, are very bad. What we can see by localizing the AG2 compounds, this is this glucose analog and SR101, is that we have really a very nice overlap between the uptake of this glucose analog with the astrocytes, and very, very low uptake into neurons, at least into the neuronal cell bodies. Also, I'd like to stress here that we can make a firm claim about AG2 take-up in astrocytes and neurons with respect to the cell bodies and not so much to the fine processes, because we simply are not there yet in these very low signal ranges with our resolution. Yes? Yes. Yep. No, it, as I said, it's not metabolized. It's probably just transported into the cells and is not phosphorylated, unfortunately. This is, yep. Well, actually, 2DG is metabolized one step. So it's the hexokinase is probably not acting on AG2, unfortunately. So it's like 6 NBDG. 6 NBDG is also a transport a transporter tracer, if you want. It's not like 2 NBDG or 2DG. No, they don't. They don't. It's known that they don't. And also in terms of monocarboxylate transporter. But this is in terms of the glucose transporters. It's known that they are not the same. Yeah. Yes. But there's a lot of buts. This is one big but, that it could be just a bias towards a transporter affinity for this compound. I completely agree. We have not characterized it further. This is work that is done in another lab in collaboration with us, but we haven't had yet the results. What we know is that this glucose analog passes gap junctions in astrocytic networks. So we collaborate with Christian Giom in Paris, who has the compound and looked at it injected it into single astrocyte and has looked at the gap junction traversing of a compound, and this does work. Yes. Yes. You just missed it, my introduction. No problem. There is 2 MBDG and 6 MBDG. The 2-photon efficiency of this new glucose analog is about 100 times higher than for 2 and 6 MBDG. So it's a much brighter fluorescence glucose analog for 2-photon microscopy. It's not so good for single photon measurements. There, the differences are not high, not large to the NBDG analogs. It's the optimum. It's the optimum. So they have characterized the spectrum and it's the optimum. Yeah, but this is nicely described in the Angewandte Chemie paper he's published about the compound. We have a nice peak around 780 nanometers, very nicely characterized. But you could also go up a little bit. But there was no reason not to stay with 780 nanometers for this experiment. What I think this is really preliminary and of course unpublished because there are a lot of open questions. What really happens? I'm sorry, you can't really see. Maybe in these images, no. This is more like a quantification of the spatial overlaps between the HE2 and the SR101 channel. With this PDM analysis, where you see that they nicely overlap, and that what we have also done is activation studies, and we see that this overlap actually increases under stimulation, so that the co-localization of HE2 take-up and astrocytes actually increases under stimulation conditions. But as I said, we don't know a lot about the transporter kinetics of this tracer. We don't know the neuronal. What we can say is that the neuron cell bodies are clearly spared out. They don't take up the analog, but we have of course difficulties to see what happens in the neuropil. We simply cannot resolve it at this stage using this compound. So we have to be a bit cautious. But when you look at astrocytic and neuronal cell bodies, we clearly see that it's going much more into astrocytes. Yeah.
So if this molecule is split, is it split in the astrocyte? Is it metabolized?
No, as I said, it's not metabolized.
It's not
metabolized. No. It's like 6 MBDG. It's a transporter. It's a transporter tracer, if you want. Yeah. Okay. So I think I will stop here. So the idea again is that glucose is taken up by astrocytes, converted to lactate. That this lactate probably is the main substrate that is also transported within. The astrocytic network, but is then shuttled over to the neurons where it's metabolized oxidatively to produce energy.
So lactate is always, in a sort of lactate shuttle hypothesis, always within the astrocytes, or it's not within the extracellular space? The extracellular space in the brain hide in lactate?
I don't think it has been really measured in comparison with the astrocytic concentration. I don't think anybody has really measured.
Yeah. And if we recovery rate of 5% in the microdialysis is true, then the concentration in the extracellular space is around 1.5 million molar. That scales well with what somebody, I mean, other person have found with other methodologies. And you get an increase in lactate concentration than you do for lung stimulation. You can show that very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So you think the extracellular space then is like a local battery?
But
yeah,
yep. 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 But I mean, concentration does not one-to-one tell us anything about the real flux of the metabolite yet. So, but there are also, of course, other studies using NMR, for instance, seeing that lactate levels go up with increased activation, probably.
Yeah.
But not really telling us a lot about, first, the real compartmentation of the lactate, of course, because they lack the resolution, and also not telling us a lot about the real flux yet.
Centrum to the surface of the brain.
Right.
So you would probably be more happy to drain up here than to drain from the ventricles.
Okay, so you're saying that I could turn in principle some kind of surface electrode over the end.
Yeah.
And if I had some way of measuring concentrations, that might be a good measure.
Yeah.
That's not so crazy. Right?
No. The brain increases locally. It becomes higher than the blood, then you will have a...
If it's not metabolized, yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, in principle, it would be washed out. I mean, nobody knows about this, except that from these human studies, you can see an effluxof lactate from the brain. If they give they can see how, give a glucose compound and see how it's metabolized. They can see that, of course, a lot is going into the brain. Also, that is produced, lactate is produced in the brain and actually washed down.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have an exchange across the blood-brain barrier of lactate all the time.
Yeah. And also, of course, when you give lactate in IV, either as a tracer or in physiological concentrations, we always have something coming in, something coming out. But the proof that we have CO2 labeled C11 labeled CO2 actually washed out from the brain says that lactate that's coming in also is really metabolized, right?
Yeah.
So maybe I should stop here and save you with the last part, or not. It's up to you. Okay. So, as you know, we have actually heard a lot of introductions about it. I will really go fast here. We have one hypothesis that it might be that astrocytic mGluR5 senses the glutamate concentration around the synapse, and that this would initiate the signaling for increasing blood flow under increased glutamatergic transmission. And these are the very prominent papers that have shown this effect by blocking astrocytic mGluR5, that they could reduce the hemodynamic response. This is what we wanted to do also, initially as a control experiment, and we have that I can take, that I can say right now, we have failed to reproduce this result. What we have done is now in a larger experimental series, we have done optical imaging of intrinsic signals, actually on a spectroscopic level, and together with laser speckle imaging of blood flow, also to then derive CMRO2 values. This is, I'd say, straightforward optical spectroscopy and blood flow measurements, as also used in other labs, for instance, in David Boas's lab, Anna Devor's lab, Jason Berrick's lab. And at the same time, this is in a way new, we again use these beta probes, and we had this compound, 11C-ABP, that happened to be synthesized in our facility, and this is a specific tracer for mGluR5. So by actually doing the experiment with blocking mGluR5 with MPEP at the same time with C11-ABP beta probe studies, we could measure receptor occupancy at the same time as we have measured the hemodynamic response to stimulation increases. And to give you a very brief summary, what we see is no effects under heavy blocking of the mGluR5 in all the hemodynamic response amplitudes. I have to say, under brief stimulation, I think this is key. We stimulated for 4 seconds. In these short stimulation hemodynamic responses, we do not see any influence under heavy blocking. 4 hertz piezo electric stimulation of a single whisker. And this shows you now the receptor, the tracer displacement experiment with ABP. What we can do with these measures is actually to quantify receptor occupancy. With the highest dose that we used, we could block 80%, about 80% of mGluR5. And that had no effect on the hemodynamic response to brief stimulations. Somewhat disappointing on the one hand. On the other hand, it's an open, I think it's an open debate still, particularly for the initiation of the hemodynamic response, whether the mGluR5 actually plays a role at all. And I think it's a very, it started with a control condition, but I think it's a quite a, an interesting set of results we have here. One small thing, that with the dosages that are reported in a few of these studies, you can hardly block mGluR5. This is, we actually, in collaboration with Novartis, we had this compound, which is about 5 times more potent than MPEP. This is called MMPEP. And the highest dose is 20 milligrams per kilo of MMPEP. That would be 20 milligrams per kilo MPEP. This is IV.
The other one is the same, but 10 times as efficient.
5 times as efficient, and we give, I mean, the we give 4 milligrams per kilo. That would be the equivalent of 20 milligrams of MPEP. Because this is what most of the others have done, and we go to local injections also. I fully agree. Yep.
But the Zonta paper, I think, was on slices.
No, they had an in vivo part.
Oh,
using laser Doppler and local field potential recordings. But I think you ask me why IV? I tell you, doesn't matter. We block the receptor to 80%. This was, at the beginning, I was also thinking maybe we don't block the receptor. But with these experiments, we can clearly prove we block it. And but we still have no effect. Exactly. Then we wouldn't see the block this tracer displacement by the impact. Thank you. Yes.
So this under stimulation we see changes in all these intrinsic signals.
Yes.
However, so from similar pictures you then generate the statistics.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The only thing, now this is really a control, was CNQX. There we could really lower the response. Just to show that we did not have something shunted to not have any change in our response. Yes? This is classical tracer kinetic modeling, where you actually look at the tracer kinetics, actually the tracer going to the tissue and actually being competitively blocked with the cold compound that is on the receptor. So the kinetics of the tracer going into the brain, coming out of the brain, are completely different if all your receptor sites where it would go are blocked competitively. So this is classical tracer kinetic modeling to come up with estimates of tracer coupling. So let me summarize. Neurons, astrocytes, vessel, the fundamental structure and fundamental unit that is interesting for all of us, I think. We have an interesting vascular system, I think. We all agree on that, that serves as a supply backbone, and we know much too little about this structure of this of the network, and we have to do more about this. We have a highly compartmentalized metabolism in the brain. I could show that the brain can oxidize lactate. I've shown that the lactate could be preferred over glucose by the brain, that lactate alone in the complete absence of glucose can sustain neuronal activity, and we have kind of unresolved signaling mechanisms between neurons, astrocytes, and vessels. And these are the people who did the work. So in red, the people in my lab that really contributed to these studies, Renaud Cholivet with the AG2 project, Matthias Wies with a whole tracer kinetic modeling, and also the VSD glucose deprivation experiments, Annalena Keller with the casts, and synchrotron radiation-based tomography, Novella with the MPEP study. Johannes is the PhD student of mine and Patrick Jenny, who is in the fluid dynamics modeling. And these are the collaborating group leaders. Thank you very much.
There are other structural maps that people claim with different degrees of being convincing to be correlated.
No, but I mean.
So, people certainly are, I think, out of that game. In the one, Grinwald showed that they rather avoid the plants. Okay, that's a different issue. So,
yep.
Why should I believe that this coming from experience, which regions really metabolize it? Or modern life?
Well, I mean, these are all older classical papers by Wong Reilly, going more into co-localizations between mitochondria and cytochrome oxidase stains, and there's a lot. I think there is a lot of evidence that it is a relative marker of metabolism, but it is by no means a quantitative measure. I mean, by no means. I completely agree with you. I'd much more prefer, for instance, something like a 2-deoxyglucose uptake pattern that, by the way, co-localizes with the cytochrome oxidase uptake level in the blobs. But it's much harder to do. Yeah, but also on the steady state and unstimulated.
Yeah.
But the cat blobs are anyway not as prominent. Huh?
So what do you're thinking like, okay, the vascular density is not higher, but maybe then during stimuli that would drive neurons in cytochrome oxidase blobs or stripes, you might expect to see greater flux of blood sit there, and that kind of confirmation has never been done. Okay. And Speckle actually, well, might give you a little bit of that, but these things should be correlated faster over the blobs.
But I think that one graph that I had with this cloud of points with all the vascular densities against the cytochrome oxidase activity in V1. Yeah, sure. Yeah, this one. So this graph here, it's a bit. So this cloud of points here that come from just these cytochrome oxidase measurements along the different lamina, where you clearly have, of course, an increase also in vascular density. You see this correlation here
across the layers.
What I want to say is that these two measures here are the blobs and interblobs. They lie completely within this range, both in vascular density and in cytochrome oxidase activity. What I want to say is that we might have an increased metabolism and also vascular density, which both turn out to be significant, but they are small in comparison to layer 4C beta. Let's say layer 4C beta and something layer 5 or something like that. These differences are much bigger. Much bigger. So I think it's a minute thing. And that they attracted so much interest is probably because they look nice. I don't know. Quite a rich literature on this, and a fantastic review by Kevin Martin in TINS, where he, Yeah, an old one, but it's a nice one. I like it, where he somehow wraps it all up. There is signatures, and. Well, there are other methods to visualize them, but it's an easy way, of course. But you may know better what other markers you can take to visualize them. In my hands, it's the best, but I could imagine better ones, more quantitative ones, like, for instance, 2-deoxyglucose measurement that is really quantitative. We have done that, but it's also, I mean, the uptake curves is nothing comparable to a radio tracer where you have a nice increase, an abrupt increase. Yes, I mean you clearly see an uptake, but it's not as you could really one to one use it as a kinetic tool to say anything about how much really goes in at this stage. I think also it's still a much too large compound. I mean, this is